This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's tension building internally and externally all around, and I think what we're seeing now is just the manifestation of that concern and that stress growing.
That's Cameron Hudson from the Center for Strategic and International Studies on the current political turmoil in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, a South African court hears arguments over government's plans to invalidate visas for long-staying Zimbabweans. And a seven-story building under construction in Nigeria collapses. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sudanese in the capital Khartoum and other cities across the country woke up today to a dramatic escalation in tensions between Sudan's armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF. In a televised report, Army spokesperson Brigadier Nabil Abdullah said recent RSF deployments in Khartoum and other cities have stirred up panic and fear among people. VOA's Nabil Biagio reports.
Army spokesperson Nabil Abdullah told reporters in Khartoum last night the military did not approve the Rapid Support Forces' recent deployments in Sudan.
According to the constitution and law, it is the responsibility of the Sudanese armed forces to maintain the security and safety of the country in cooperation with various state agencies, and the laws have organized this cooperation. Accordingly, we must push the alarm button because the country is passing a historic and dangerous curve, and the risk increases with the rapid support forces by mobilizing forces and spreading up inside the capital, Khartoum, and some cities.
Abdullah said the army has tried to find an amicable solution to its dispute with the RSF, but warned the situation risks an outright war. The dispute between the RSF and national forces was exacerbated by talks to create a transitional government to eventually hold elections and put a civilian administration in place.
The armed forces kept on in finding peaceful solutions to these violations, to keep it peaceful in general, and an unwillingness of an armed conflict that can destroy everything, because all of these foresee incursions, and redeployment is not one of the systems or duties of the rapid support forces and its work. It is in an obvious violation of the law, and it's against the Security Committee's instructions.
Abdullah said the recent deployments could worsen an already volatile political and security situation in Sudan. The military's statement came as the RSF deployed troops in River Nile State on the border with Egypt. Local media reported the force is attempting to build a base in the town of Merowe. The RSF responded by saying its presence in Merowe is in line with its operations and duties in all Sudan's states to maintain security and tranquility. The RSF's statement urged the public and the media not to pay mind to disinformation it said is meant to fuel the fire of sedition and undermine the country's peace and security. The statement concluded by threatening to sue entities it said propagate false news at the expense of the country's peace and security. The RSF is seen as allied with Sudan's former president Omar al-Bashir, who was ousted by massive protests in 2019. Many people in the Darfur region know it as a deadly force formerly known as the Janjaweed, accused of committing atrocities during Bashir's three decades in power, especially in the Darfur region. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
As we just heard, hundreds of protesters took to the streets of Khartoum today as talks with Sudan's army rulers to bring in a civilian government hit a roadblock. Security forces confronted the demonstrators in Sudan's capital with tear gas and stun grenades. For further perspective on the situation, I talked to Cameron Hudson, a former U.S. diplomat and currently a senior associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, I think what we're seeing is just the manifestation of the building stress, both within the security forces, but also within civilian elements. We have been in a period of sort of suspended animation for the last month, where we have seen very little forward progress on resolving some of the big issues around security sector reform and, you know, the future of the security forces' role in the country. And we're seeing tension now building both within the military and between the military and the paramilitary group RSF, and then with both of those groups, with the Forces for Freedom and Change and the civilian political movements. So there's tension building internally and externally all around, and I think what we're seeing now is just the manifestation of that concern and that stress growing.
Is this group, the Rapid Support Force and the Sudanese Army, positioning themselves and against each other? Is it all about each group trying to retain power?
I think at a base level, yes. I think that it's more though that there's an uncertainty about the future, and that what we're seeing is a kind of game of cat and mouse between all of these groups and people trying to build alliances and position themselves so that when the reforms are undertaken, that there is some guarantee, at least for the command of these groups, that they will be protected, that their interests will be protected, that their money will be protected, that they personally will be protected. And I think it's that uncertainty which is creating all of this tension right now.
The coup has also plunged the nation into an economic crisis, as Western governments have stalled their financial assistance. So how is Sudan going to move forward with this kind of animosity between army groups and activists?
Well, I think you're seeing a very deliberate, very intensive international mediation effort trying to bring the various factions of the security forces together to create a common understanding of what their role should be in a future Sudanese state. And unless and until that is done with some measure of confidence, then I think that this transition will be in doubt. The future of Sudan will be in doubt. These are the most essential questions that will determine Sudan's future. And if we can't get it right, then you risk seeing the country plunged back into war with itself.
That's Cameron Hudson from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He talked with me from Washington. Thousands of Zimbabweans living in South Africa face an uncertain future and possible deportation before a June 2023 expiration of their work permits. The Zimbabwe exemption permit holders are now pinning their hopes on the country's judicial system. Today, legal representatives of the Zimbabwe Immigration Federation address the court. We have online in Johannesburg reporter Tuso Kumalo, who is closely monitoring the proceedings. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Tuso.
Welcome. Very good evening.
So, what was the main argument of the legal representatives today?
The lead advocate for the Zimbabwe Immigration Federation was Advocate Tembega Mkwaitobi. His argument was really based on 4 points. First, you are saying to the court the decision to terminate these permits was irrational, and indicating that they did not consider, the Home Affairs Department did not consider the impact that the decision would have to these Zimbabweans. They've stayed for almost a decade with children going to school, them starting families, and of course uprooting them within a year to tell them to go back. And his point number two was that the decision itself was arbitrary in the case, in the sense that it did not take into consideration the law of justice, which says the parties that are affected should be consulted before authorities take such decisions. His point number three was the termination itself was detached from the reasons as to why those permits were given in the first instance, giving an example that one of the reasons given by the Home Office to give those permits was that there was a political and economic situation in Zimbabwe that was pushing people to go into South Africa. And he went ahead and gave a report from organizations like Amnesty International and other organizations showing that that political situation still exists in Zimbabwe, that economic situation still exists in Zimbabwe, and saying Therefore, there was no basis on why those permits were now being removed while those situations were still prevailing. And of course, the last point was they are seeking an interim relief. That is another extension in case they lose the case. Those people should be protected by an interim relief in the form of extension, so that while they appeal, those people would not be arrested, would not be deported. And those are some of the main points that he was basing his argument on.
So how did the Home Affairs Department respond?
Of course, the Home Affairs Department fumbled in many aspects, not even addressing some of the points. Their first point was it was the minister's powers to make that decision, to terminate the permit, and the minister did that, a point that was not disputed, of course, by the applicants, because the applicants were saying their issue was in the way that decision, that power was exercised, which is a problem. They went ahead again on behalf of the minister to say the permits were given a lifespan, so it was natural that they would come to an end, so no one should cry foul, because even the applicants would have known that the permits were going to come to an end. Their other point was they insisted that the minister's decision was a fair one, because he gave an extension of 12 months for those applicants to make other avenues and apply for other permits, so it was fair in that case. And they are saying those the applicants were given options. Like if they wanted, if they are interested in other permits, they would apply for them. If they are interested in seeking asylum, they would do that. But of course, the applicants' advocates coming hard on that, saying the asylum system does not work. The permit system has a lot of backlogs, so it's not understandable why the department will ask these applicants to go into that route where it's already known that it cannot handle tens of thousands in addition to what already is struggling with at the moment.
So tomorrow is the day of arguments too. So what is expected and when can we expect a ruling?
In fact, this case is divided into two parts. What is happening is that there is the main case with the Helen Suzman Foundation, which was also supported by these organizations, including the Zimbabwe Immigration Federation. So in that case, judgment has been reserved, but there is a party that's coming in tomorrow, the Zimbabwe Exemption Permit Association. They are coming with a different angle, and their case has been separated to this one. So this first case, judgment has been reserved tomorrow. The same court is going to be hearing the Zimbabwe Exemption Permit Holders Association. As to when the judgment that was reserved today is going to be handed down, it's a very difficult one, because it was a full bench of three judges, and they are still going to sit down and make positions and come together and have one solid judgment. So the judgment for now is reserved in this case, and we're not sure when they are going to head it down.
Tuso Kumalo in Johannesburg, closely monitoring the court hearings. Thank you for your input.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. International Monetary Fund Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva today warned against the danger of a new Cold War as national leaders work to make their industrial supply chains more secure and geopolitical tensions between major powers rise. She said it is possible to enhance supply line security without edging the world into a Cold War-style confrontation. Reuters News reports she made the comments on the IMF and World Bank annual spring meeting here in Washington. Also at the meeting today, Germany's finance minister welcomed a signal from China that it may drop a demand for multilateral banks to be involved in debt restructuring for poorer countries. That shift could remove a roadblock to debt relief for countries struggling to repay loans as they confront rising interest rates, economic weakness, and inflation. There have been reports that Beijing would back away from that demand, and Christian Lindner said China appears to accept its responsibility as the major creditor of low-income countries. China is a major creditor for many highly indebted countries in Africa and Asia. The Africa FinTech Summit wrapped up yesterday with entrepreneurs from the continent saying they are excited to see the growth of the financial technology industry. VOA's Mike Hove attended the summit that saw entrepreneurs and founders of African startups interacting among themselves and with global finance institutions and U.S. officials. This to ensure more investment and continuous growth of the fintech sector on the continent. Hove spoke with Mercy Irhai Wariansusu, one of the event's keynote speakers and the intensives manager at Halkion.
This summit for me is important because it places Africa at the center where she should be. It's important because it's bringing together ecosystem partners, giving them an opportunity to connect with one another. It's really important for ecosystem actors to be able to get together, be on the same page about the values that align. And for us, it's also important because it's an opportunity to connect with people who are also impact-driven focused.
Now, I'm really also curious. I know our fintech has been regarded as the fastest growing sector on the continent. Considering all the challenges that we face, we've got infrastructure issues, network issues, etc., how is it still that fintech is the fastest growing sector?
I think part of the reason is that fintech answers a need to challenges that different African countries are facing. Even if you take, for example, M-Pesa and the fact that what M-Pesa was doing in Kenya and East Africa didn't even exist in the U.S. at the time. I think it's kind of like that whole adage of necessity is the mother of invention. And I think in a lot of the startups in the fintech space are looking at what is needed and what the where the gaps are and the problems are. And it's kind of allowing us to and I hate to use the very common word, but kind of leapfrog where even Western countries are today. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to continue to be a fastest growing part of the economy.
In fact, Western leaders seem to be hailing Africa. I know our Vice President Kamala Harris verbatim said Africa is the next place where digital innovation will be the big thing. How does that make creators and entrepreneurs like yourself feel?
I don't even think it should be said that it's the next place. It should be the place. And I'm very glad to hear that the U.S. government is saying that and supporting founders. I think that we need to kind of see more support.
Now talk to me about how your institution is helping Africa's fintech sector grow.
So what we're doing is we provide community space and access. We provide training, leadership training. A lot of our fellows are, when they leave us, they always speak about how they've grown as a leader. We look at the way we support our fellows holistically. We don't just focus on the business. We focus on the person. So we provide them access to mentors where they get a chance to work with people one-on-one, go over their business models, learn their pitch, hone their pitch. A lot of our founders have not had to have had the same level of rigorous pitching that they undergo when they come to Halcyon. And they always complain, but by the time they're done their program, they're always very grateful that they had the opportunity to actually hone not just their pitch, but like tighten their business model. We also provide support in partnership with other actors like AWS, where we give them access to credits. And we provide a network of either investors, just our alumni community and all of that. And that's one of the ways that we like to come around our fellows and support them, not just while they're with us, but even into the future.
That was Mercy Erhi Wariansusu, a keynote speaker at the Africa FinTech Summit and the intensives manager at Halkion. She spoke with VOA's Mike Hove from the event yesterday at the Washington Convention Center. There are currently a shortage of U.S. dollars in a number of African countries, including Egypt, Ghana, Kenya, and Zambia. Africa relies on the dollar for major transactions such as debt repayments. The dollar crisis is giving impetus to calls for the continent to de-dollarize. Darren Taylor reports.
Many countries want to establish mechanisms to trade without U.S. dollars, especially because of the fallout from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Western sanctions targeting Moscow have affected Russia's relationship with its main trading partners, including in Africa. Russian President Vladimir Putin is encouraging his African allies to de-dollarize. South African economist Lebohang Peko analyzes financial flows around the continent.
Most of the purchases take place in dollars US internationally, and many of the loans that are taken by developing countries from the IMF and the World Bank by default have been in dollars. So as a result of this, as economies become sluggish and have been sluggish, particularly over the past 3 years, there has been less of an inflow of dollars in foreign reserves, and also that there's been a higher indebtedness. There's been a higher rate of payment to international agencies such as your IMF. It doesn't help also that, of course, as we're aware, petrol and fuel are also bought in dollars.
Peko says having the dollar as a reserve currency has been the status quo for decades, so developing countries in particular haven't needed to keep stocks of other currencies. This, she says, is changing because of global economic tumult and a weakened confidence in the US dollar.
This scenario is one of an emerging financial balance of power, or the birth of a new global economic order that is not Western dominated.
Professor Evaristo Benyera is a political economist at the University of South Africa. He says the weaponization of the dollar has sparked the global south into considering an alternative reserve currency.
The seizure of Russian assets, Russian reserve currency, by the United States and its allies implied that every other country was a potential victim to this system of, if you do not agree with the United States or its allies, we will impose economic sanctions on you. Just ask Zimbabwe. So there is.
Benyera sees Africa following the de-dollarization mission of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. This group includes China, Russia, and Iran, with powers such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey awaiting membership. Benyera says the SCO will eventually represent more than 40% of the world population.
This is a propitious moment for Africa to realize what the likes of Kwame Nkrumah have always been agitating for, that Africa needs its own currency. This is an opportunity for Africa to decouple from the global West and regain its sovereignty. Imagine a scenario in which our region is SADC, our reserve currency is the South African rand. Then you go to West Africa, our reserve currency is the Naira.
That will mean, says Benyera, Africa won't need to toe Western foreign policy lines, giving the continent greater control over its wealth, like gold. But, even he asks, is Africa ready to assume greater control over its economic future?
Unfortunately, the elephant in the room is the leadership, a just and ethical leadership in Africa, a leadership that will eat last, not those that put themselves in front of the queue and kick the ladder.
If that isn't in place, says Benyera, Africans on the whole won't benefit from the continent's wealth, no matter the currencies their governments hold in reserve. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
This is your feedback on WhatsApp.
And now, time for a listener's comment. He says, I'm an ardent listener and viewer of all your programmings, spanning over a period of 23 years. I am happy to be, and I would continue to do so. Thank you, VOA. It's me, your listener, Tijani Muhammad from Lokojo, Kogi State, North Central Nigeria. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.